Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the President saying today that he's not happy with the bipartisan deal to avoid another government shutdown over his border wall as the Friday deadline looms, and speak with Erin Coulihan, a writer from El Paso who covers the border and immigration for Rolling Stone, Elle, Teen Vogue, and has an article at CNN, Trump's Distorted View of Life in El Paso, and another at Elle, Inside Trump's El Paso MAGA Rally. She joins us to describe the dueling rallies on Monday in El Paso between Beto O'Rourke and Donald Trump, and her own experience of being harassed at the Trump rally by a supporter of the president wearing a MAGA hat, who insulted and taunted her as a member of the evil media, shouting, "Build that wall," before physically assaulting a cameraman from the BBC. We'll discuss Trump's latest ploy to invent a new reality in lieu of getting his border wall by saying, "We already have a border wall." So now, instead of chanting, "Build the wall," he is urging his followers to chant the new slogan on display, "Finish the wall." We'll also look into the demonization and baiting of the press by Trump, but in particular by his son, Don Jr., who did the warm-up act, rambling on about liking Texas and playing with machine guns amid insults to the press and taking shots at Beto O'Rourke. Then we'll examine the latest sex scandal, this time not in the Catholic Church, but among officials in the Southern Baptist churches, including pastors, deacons, Sunday school teachers, and volunteers, revealed by the Houston Chronicle and the San Antonio Express News in their Abuse of Faith investigation series. Frederick Clarkson, an analyst of the religious right for over 30 years and author of Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy, joins us to discuss an article he wrote in 2014 exposing sex abuse in the Southern Baptist Convention and the latest revelations of 380 Southern Baptists abusing more than 700 victims. Then finally, we will speak with world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual Henry Giroux, the author of American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism, who joins us to discuss his article at Truthout, Resisting the Weaponization of Ignorance in the Age of Trump. We'll discuss how democracies in Poland, Hungary, India, Turkey, and recently Brazil have succumbed to fascist takeovers by demagogues, and how the United States is not immune to the same forces of malicious ignorance and arrogant anti-intellectualism led by our own Donald Trump. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now from El Paso, Texas, is Erin Coulihan, a writer and scholar covering border and immigration issues. Her work appears in Rolling Stone, Elle, Teen Vogue, and she has an article at CNN, Trump's Distorted View of Life in El Paso, and another at Elle, Inside Trump's El Paso MAGA Rally. Welcome to Background Briefing, Erin Coulihan.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Well, thanks, Ellen. And tell me about what happened there, Erin, just as you were actually abused by the same person who assaulted the BBC cameraman. So just set us up, if you will, about, I take it you were in a cage, right, or at least in an area.
I was, yes. Yeah, it was like a press pen is what they called it, which was a little nicer than a cage.
Go ahead. So what was it like?
I mean, it had been pretty polite for the entire time. I got there around 1 p.m. to start interviewing people, and I was expecting a lot of aggression from the attendees, but people were pretty polite, you know, respectful. No one turned me down for an interview or insulted me or was rude at all. But once Donald Trump Jr. got on the stage, I've never seen a room with that many people change so quickly before. And I mean, I cover music festivals. Just the tone of the way he was speaking about the media being negative and the media being, you know, the enemy of the people, and the way the crowd started to swell, I got the sense that something was going to happen. And then the man who was in the tan shirt and the MAGA hat was standing in front of where I was and turned around, and I thought maybe he was going to take a selfie with Trump behind him, as other attendees were. But he started trying to obstruct my view with my iPhone and with my professional camera that I was shooting with so that I couldn't get a good shot. And I'm, you know, like trying to go around him saying, excuse me, sir, like I'm trying to do my job. And then he started, you know, with the evil media, you know, why are you here? You know, it's your fault, calling me a commie. And I did what I could to get away from the area. And a couple minutes later, I noticed some students who were reaching into their coats. And I thought, huh, well, they're reaching for something and hoping it wasn't a gun. It turned out not to be a gun, thankfully, but it was a banner in protest for the El Paso Nine, who are a group of six detainees who are on a hunger strike and have been subjected to torture by being force-fed within the last week or so. So the students, there were three of them, drop this banner and start chanting, and then immediately the Secret Service was on them and escorted them out. At about the same time, other protesters started dropping similar banners from different areas of the arena, which is, I think, why a lot of the shots of Trump were tight, and he himself even paused a little bit to see what was going on. So I thought, well, that right there is going to be a story. So I followed them out so I could interview the teenagers about what happened. And when I got back, it was just madness because Donald Trump was speaking about, you know, how horrible the media was, and people were getting more and more angry. And I decided, you know what, I'm just going to go home at this point, because I did very much get the sense that something was about to happen. And then by the time I got home, the news had struck that the man, the same man who had been trying to, you know, swap my phone out of my hand, had knocked over a bunch of cameras and had pretty much tried to tackle the press. Like, what? This cannot be serious. Sure enough, once I looked at the footage, he jumped in the exact spot that I was in.
So, again, I'm speaking with Erin Coulihan, who is in El Paso. She's a writer and scholar covering the border and immigration issues. Her work appears in Rolling Stone, Elle, Teen Vogue, and she has an article at CNN, Trump's Distorted View of Life in El Paso, and another at Elle, Inside Trump's El Paso MAGA Rally. So what I don't understand, though, is the disconnect here, in as much as we know that there are a lot of right-wing conspiracy followers. The QAnon group were there. There's one right in the front behind Trump with a reference to QAnon, which is a weird group that believe that Trump is saving us from a pedophile ring that's secretly running the United States government. And then you had right in the front row Elmer Stuart Rhodes, the founder of the far-right militia group, the Oath Keepers. And as you said, Donald Trump did the warm-up act and got everybody riled up, and Trump did the same. But I also understand that over the PA, they kept reminding the crowd not to beat up the protesters. And there were some very brave protesters outside the arena, the Coliseum there in El Paso, young Latinos holding up signs saying Trump is a lying, corrupt racist and abolish ICE. And apparently they stood their ground, although they were cursed by the crowd leaving the Coliseum. So that seems a bit of a disconnect to me, Erin. On the one hand, the PA system is urging Trump's followers not to beat up the press and beat up demonstrators. At the same time, they're riling them up. So did you notice that?
I did notice that. And what I thought was interesting was that all the protesters were told that they had to remain on the outside of the gate in separate, isolated lots from the event. And I thought, okay, that's interesting. Maybe, you know, it really is to ensure safety, which is great. But as the day wore on and the press wasn't allowed inside the Coliseum until there was a sufficient number of attendees inside, because the campaign didn't want any pictures to be taken or any kind of coverage of an empty Coliseum. So I think that was kind of the same thing. They know what their optics are for this first big rally of the 2020 campaign, and I don't think that they wanted any attention to be taken away from them or have any sort of media speculation or shot that they couldn't control at that point, because there wasn't any press really on the outside of the fences where the protesters were when people were leaving.
Right, but wasn't there a full crowd, and there are reports that there are some 6,000 in the overflow crowd? So it seems like Trump attracted a lot of people.
he did attract a lot of people, which I thought was incredible. I interviewed people who had come from as far as Arkansas, South Carolina, Florida, and many from New Mexico. I talked to a couple of vendors and asked them where they had come from. Both had been from South Carolina. It was a man and a woman. And I asked them what they were doing and, you know, why did they come to El Paso to sell MAGA t-shirts and caps and things like that. And they said because their president had created these jobs for them. And I said, well, you know, you could sell merchandise for any candidate or, you know, outside any event or do any sort of vending like that. And they denied it, that thought completely, and said, no, our president created this job, which is just so weird for me to see happen in my hometown because those people were not from here. They weren't, you know, necessarily the target audience. And then at that point, I realized, you know, just how serious this rally was going to be in terms of its impact on our culture.
Well, it seems that El Paso is sort of a living embodiment of, you know, racial harmony, if you will, with the president who started his campaign demonizing Mexicans and who has created this whole illusion about invasions from the south, white identity under attack, the need for a wall. All of this stuff is a manufactured crisis and a manufactured division, which is just inescapably racist. And yet my understanding is that El Paso, which is a city the size of Boston, actually is very harmonious between whites and Latinos.
Absolutely. I grew up in El Paso. I'm 30 years old and I've lived here most of my life, except when I went away for graduate school. And I've never really had any sort of experience that I've seen, whether in school, whether out with my friends, whether at a restaurant, of any real sort of negative racism or overt racism between people from El Paso. Now that becomes different when we get people in from out of town. We have a large army base called Fort Bliss, and there's been instances when my friends who are Mexican or Latinx or a person of color has gone out and experienced very, very overt racism from people who were here from out of town.
Well, indeed, the young Latinos demonstrating outside of the Coliseum where the Trump rally was, who were greeted by the angry crowd, who were called upon to restrain themselves, nevertheless cursed them and told them to go back to Mexico. But the thing that caught my attention, and you were there, so I'd like to get your firsthand report on it, Aaron Coulihan, the big banners were up there, finish the wall. And it looks like Trump has just, he's brilliant at lying because I really don't think he knows the difference between the truth and lies. And he buys his own lies. And I think in his head, he's figured out, well, I can't get my wall, or at least the one that I promised that Mexico was going to pay for. But now I'm going to say, finish the wall. And that's apparently his new tack. He's saying that. He said that today to reporters in the Oval Office, that the wall is almost finished. Which, of course, is not true. So is that what he's going to do now, just to justify these little changes, this 55 miles of the 2,000-mile border that are going to have some kind of offense? Do you think it's going to work? Do you think that his supporters will actually believe that he's now saying that the wall is almost finished and the new chant is finish the wall?
It was completely unbelievable to me because I read that and it said, finish the wall. And I thought, what are they even referring to? El Paso does not have a wall. We have an eyesore of a fence that I drive by every day on my way to work. And, you know, it's something that no one really has ever given much attention to. And the first thing Trump said yesterday when he got on that stage was that he had begun the process of building a wall on top of the Rio Grande, and everybody cheered. And I looked around thinking, like, surely the people who live in El Paso realize that the Rio Grande bisects our city. You know, how would that work? It wouldn't. There's no possible way it could work. And yet, as I was interviewing people, I interviewed one woman who said that she's lived in El Paso for the past 50 years, and that, you know, she's never felt safer now that Trump is going to finish the wall. I said, can you give me an example of how you felt unsafe before? Because we have a statistic that shows that crime in El Paso actually rose 5.5% after the installation of the fence. And, you know, this number and this belief of yours don't seem to add up. And she said that she knew, she absolutely knew that there is crime everywhere in El Paso, but because now the wall was finally going to finish being built, she also knew for a fact that it was going to stop. I interviewed other students who said that they've never felt safe in El Paso before because there hasn't been some sort of physical barrier, and that finally, now that they were going to be done building the wall, they felt safe in the city. Again, I asked them, can you give me an example of the city not being safe? And they really couldn't. And it's become an interesting battle of semantics, I think, because every single person said, I know there's crime. I know there's crime. But there was no sort of like cognitive thought or thinking process to retrieve the memory or be able to dispute it one way or the other with either evidence, you know, a statistic or an actual experience of their own. They're just, I think, kind of blindly attaching themselves to this idea.
Well, it's pretty extraordinary that the president can go from Mexico building the wall to demanding $5.7 billion and turning down $25 billion, by the way, earlier, and then now accepting $1.375 billion. And the way that he's justifying it is, along with saying he's not happy because his right-wing supporters are all indignant about it, in the same photo op today in the White House where he said he wasn't happy about the bipartisan border security compromise, although he probably will sign it, he said, right now we're building a lot of wall. Well, that is just not true. But that's the new reality.
Maybe it's like political division. Right.
I mean, is that really what it comes down to, that he's just basically going to move the goalposts in a kind of fantasy world and they'll all accept that the wall has largely been built?
I think so, because he's become such a big, you know, symbol of everything that hatred and racism and xenophobia represents. Last night, Donald Trump Jr., called Beto O'Rourke and the Democratic Party deplorables and said that the Democratic Party was just a caricature of itself. I don't believe that to be true because his father has a baby blimp of him that was sitting in El Paso, but unfortunately it was too windy for it to be inflated. But it's an interesting metaphor because on the one hand, you think, okay, he's just pushing through this as a symbol, but you don't put the mascot in as your quarterback. He's has a horrible reputation of leadership, and I think the party right now is struggling with, okay, how are we going to maintain any sort of united or, you know, aggressive force with this, and he's just becoming increasingly bombastic.
Or unhinged would be another word, which I would use. But I thank you for joining us, Aaron Coulihan. I appreciate it very much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Aaron Coulihan, who is in El Paso. She's a writer and scholar covering border and immigration issues. Her work appears in Rolling Stone, Elle, Teen Vogue, and she has an article at CNN, Trump's Distorted View of Life in El Paso, and another at Elle, Inside Trump's El Paso MAGA Rally. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking into another sex scandal in a different church. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Frederick Clarkson, a senior fellow at Political Research Associates and an analyst of the religious right for over 30 years. He's worked as an investigative editor at Planned Parenthood Federation of America, as communications director at the Institute for Democracy Studies, and co-founded the important group blog about the Christian right, Talk to Action. His books include Dispatches from the Religious Left, The Future of Faith and Politics in America, and Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frederick Clarkson.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thank you. And the Houston Chronicle and the San Antonio Express News have launched an investigative series, which they published over the weekend, Abuse of Faith. And it reports that about 220 Southern Baptist church leaders and volunteers have been convicted or have pled guilty to sexual misconduct in the last two decades, and that about 380 Southern Baptists who face allegations from more than 700 victims are also in that same time frame. So I don't know how this compares to the ongoing sexual abuse stories that are associated with the Catholic Church, but this certainly is a bit of a bombshell. But what I find extraordinary, Frederick, is that back on January the 27th of 2014, you wrote an article, When the Family Values Agenda Includes Child Sex Abuse, and you were covering the same issue, which is sexual abuse amongst the Southern Baptist Convention.
Well, yeah, it's been festering for a long time. And there are certainly Southern Baptist leaders who tried to make an issue of it, tried to get a sort of a Baptist equivalent of a sex offender registry, but the Southern Baptist Convention wouldn't do it. They have an unusual structure in that one of the strengths of the Baptist world generally is that all their churches are independent, and they arrive at their own ideas, and there isn't much accountability to hierarchies. That's been terrific, but at the same time, it meant that the Southern Baptist Convention national organization felt that there wasn't anything that they could do to supervise all of these independent churches. That was a reality, but it was also a convenience, which meant that they really didn't have to take decisive action on a profound moral issue.
So I imagine then for the reporters at the Houston Chronicle and the San Antonio Express News, it was difficult to compile this list of abusers and victims.
It was, and they had to go around interviewing the advocacy groups and the sex crimes prosecutors and delve deep into courthouse records and so on. And, yeah, because there were a lot of people, including survivors, who don't want to talk, and certainly an old boy network that doesn't want to be held accountable was very resistant to their inquiries.
So is there any similarities between this and the ongoing revelations about systemic abuse in the Catholic Church?
Well, there are. I mean, one is that the problem was allowed to fester by church leaders at all levels. You know, almost all of them men, and feeling that it would be scandalous to them personally, not in their best interests, to pursue these things. So, for example, in the case of the 2014 article you referenced earlier, there was a youth music minister in a major church in Texas, and he was caught in a series of molestations, but he was quietly let go. The church authorities never called the police, and this guy managed to get another job in a similar position at a church in Mississippi where he did the same thing. Then, they also didn't call the police on the advice of their attorney, who was a member of the church and also happened to be a member of the state House of Representatives, who in the following year or two became the first Republican speaker in the Mississippi House since Reconstruction. And so there's a line of accountability that goes right to the top within the Southern Baptist Convention, because the minister at this church where a child molester ended up was on the National Leadership Council of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, which is basically the political arm, policy arm of the Southern Baptist Convention that was responsible for adjudicating exactly these issues. In that year that I was writing about this, they had their annual conference, specially themed to issues of sexuality, and they were concerned about marriage and divorce and homosexuality and all kinds of range of issues that might be confronting the church, except the issue of child sex abuse generally and in the church in particular. And this pastor was a panelist at this conference, and everybody knew what the issue was.
Did they know he was guilty?
Well, the pastor wasn't guilty except for complicity and cover-up.
No.
But yeah, this was an issue in the church.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say that the leaders absolutely knew, but I think they can say that it's unlikely they did not know.
And again, I'm speaking with Frederick Clarkson, who's a senior fellow at Political Research Associates and an analyst of the religious right for over 30 years. He's worked as an investigative editor at Planned Parenthood Federation of America, as communications director at the Institute for Democracy Studies, and co-founder of the important group blog about the Christian right, Talk to Action. And his books include Dispatches from the Religious Left, The Future of Faith and Politics in America, and Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy. And in terms of the Southern Baptists having a very hostile position to LGBT issues and homosexuality in particular, in terms of the Catholic Church abuse, there does seem to be a systemic kind of network, if you will, of homosexual priests who prey upon boys and young men. Who are the victims of the Southern Baptist predators?
Well, I will say that within the Catholic Church, too, there's been plenty of heterosexual sex abuse, particularly of nuns, and that's been a big scandal as well.
Yeah, the Pope just brought that up recently.
Yes. Gay priests and pedophiles, but it's wider. But that said, what has come out in the Baptist setting so far seems to be predatory heterosexual men targeting women and young girls. Some of them, you know, underage, some of them not. At least that's as far as the scandal has gone so far.
So then what explains this, the idea that the churches are supposed to be sanctuaries for people, quite often people who are wounded and in trouble or going through some kind of crisis of faith? It would seem that these predators are attracted to the vulnerability of these kind of victims.
Well, absolutely, and con men are able to go a long way in these environments, and they develop, you know, con men skills that allows them to do what they do and to continue to get away with it, and to hit the road when the problems come. It's an extraordinary thing that really hits at the, just as it has for the Catholic Church, for the Baptists, it hits absolutely a conscience of who they wish to be as church and as church leaders and clergy who have a special trust relationship with their congregants. It's the most profound kind of betrayal, not just of Christian values as they understand them, but that it's a betrayal of all of society, because they're seeking the latitude that American society gives to religious organizations to cover up the crimes of serial predators, rapists, and you know, and child rapists, and they're allowed to continue to function, but allowing the church itself to be viewed as enabling a criminal enterprise.
Well, you can go back, and there have been a whole series of scandals, sex scandals, of these evangelicals. Like, remember Jimmy Swaggart, and who was the character that had the television?
Jimmy
Baker with his wife with all the makeup. It just seems to happen every few years or so. So there's no mystery about the systemic problem here. So what do you make of the response from the Southern Baptist Convention leadership? There seems to be real contrition from the president, J.D. Greer.
Yeah, it's a kind of a contrition of convenience, because he, you know, he's had these issues before him, as have the other leaders, for a very long time. And he didn't come around until things got this far, you know, when one of the biggest newspapers in the country is calling him up to ask what he was going to do about it. You know, it's all of these guys have had to come a distance, and arguably Greer may have come farther than others, but, you know, it doesn't speak much to his leadership to be suddenly contrite in a minimal kind of way after decades of knowledge of this.
Well, I believe that Billy Graham's grandson also was one of the first voices within the Southern Baptist Convention to speak out. Do you have any knowledge of that?
Bostovichian is a former federal sex crimes prosecutor in Florida.
Uh-huh.
And a law professor at Liberty University, and he has a whole organization that's devoted to investigating sex abuse in religious organizations. And he's been fierce in his criticism of these issues, wherever he finds them. But he says, and I think I quoted him in my article, as saying that the issue in the evangelical world is worse than it is in the Catholic world.
So I still am struggling, Frederick Clarkson, to try and understand why this is particularly rife amongst religious people, particularly pastors and priests. I get the idea that predators may be attracted to institutions where they are powerful authority figures to the vulnerable. That's an explanation for why it happens, but is there any kind of theological explanation for it? I guess you could make the case in the Catholic Church that the main problem is celibacy, and celibacy may well be more to do with property and not wanting to take care of widows and orphans, because about, 1,000 years ago, priests were able to marry, and then they brought in celibacy, which may well have been a way to protect property and responsibilities for widows and orphans, etc. That's at least an explanation for why it's so rife in the Catholic Church, because celibacy is a pretty high bar and a largely impossible kind of discipline to expect people to successfully manage. But what's going on the evangelical side is amongst the Southern Baptists in terms of any kind of explanation?
Quite so easily.
Okay, well, do you get...
Sure, celibacy is a high bar, but... where we're looking here about power and predation, you know, if it was just the celibacy of heterosexual men, they might find heterosexual women, but that's not the only issue. You know, we've heard about priests who've had extramarital affairs and even have children. That's outside of the rules of the church, but it's not the same thing as being a sexual predator. So the churches provide sexual predators a place to hide, and considerable cover for people who don't want to see problems where they exist because of the trust that they put in religious leaders. That's able to be exploited. And that power is, even where people might find inclinations, they find opportunities to use it. Now, I think I'm not sure if it's equally true in the Baptist world as it is in the Catholic world, which has... a more profound kind of mystique going on in the church. But even so, Baptist culture has its own version of it. And so it's easy to wrap oneself in the mantle of the faith to hide what you're doing and to create opportunities.
But what is the connection, though, between predatory and deviant sex and religion? I know I keep repeating the same question.
There's a direct connection between the deviancy and religion. Mm-hmm. I don't think I would make that case.
Mm-hmm.
There's plenty of sexual predation and that's gone on in atheist communities, for example, and the Me Too movement has caught up with some important leaders there.
Mm-hmm.
These things happen. You know, they happen in all kinds of societies. They happen in all kinds of organizations, and not just religious ones. Some religious organizations, such as most of the mainline Protestant denominations, are much more careful in being selective about who they raise up as ministers and give them appropriate training and have programs to help to deal with these situations when they come up. Unlike, say, the Baptist churches, which mostly congregations can call their own pastors with little or no training at all in anything. and they can choose their own leaders, and that's very democratic, but it also opens up the possibility of these kinds of abuses in a more profound way than with the mainline churches, which are organized to inoculate their congregations against them and to have appropriate kinds of accountability when things do happen.
Well, I don't know whether you've heard that extraordinary tape of the Mormon fundamentalist bigamist who was finally caught. And when they caught him, I think they caught him in Las Vegas. Warren Jeffs. And the really good documentary made about it. And he apparently had this, he had recorded himself sexually assaulting and raping a 14-year-old girl. And what's so spooky about it is that he's talking to her as though it's a kind of religious, with this kind of religious sanctimony, as though the rape is part of some kind of religious ritual. So that's, again, you know, where I'm struggling to understand what's different about this from, you know, you brought up the Me Too movement, et cetera.
Well, it's, again, I mean, religious organizations provide certain kinds of covers and opportunities, but there are also cultic aspects where you gain control about the dispensing people's existence, you know, and controlling access to information. And those can put people in the kind of a coercive environment that's different in more democratic kinds of settings. The Jeff, the Warren Jeff situation is obviously profoundly cultic and criminal in its orientation. And so it's under more mainstream Mormon circumstances, you wouldn't see anything like that.
Well, let's, you know, it's so depressing and so disgusting, this subject, and it continues to fester. And we continue to hear about these incidents, particularly in the Catholic Church, but now amongst the Southern Baptists. Is there any likelihood, just in closing, Frederick Clarkson, that some real measures are going to be brought in to actually deal with this rather than kick the can down the road, which seems to be the problem that the Pope's wrestling with?
Yeah, I think things are changing in society. I think the Me Too movement is both an example and a cause of that, where victims begin to find each other and find fresh ways of speaking out. The Internet provides extraordinary opportunities for exposure and accountability of the people who've been able to use older institutions to hide in the past. We've seen that with the identification of people who were in the Torchlight March in Charlottesville. You know, suddenly you could get the faces of the Nazis and find out who they were. This is the kind of thing that's now possible doing exposure and criminal accountability for child molesters and rapists.
Well, Frederick Clarkson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Frederick Clarkson, who's a senior fellow at Political Research Associates and an analyst of the religious right for over 30 years. He's worked as an investigative editor at Planned Parenthood Federation of America, as communications director at the Institute for Democracy Studies, and co-founded the important group blog about the Christian right, Talk to Action. And his books include Dispatches from the Religious Left, The Future in Faith and Politics in America, and Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how the United States is not immune to a fascist takeover by a demagogue.
I guess it would be nice to give my heart to a god, but which one do I choose? Oh, the church is filled with losers, psycho or confused.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Henry Giroux, a world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual who currently holds a McMaster University Professor for Scholarship in the Public Interest. His most recent books include Disposable Futures, Violence in the Age of Spectacle, America at War with Itself, The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism. And his latest book is American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. And he also has an article at Truth Out, Resisting the Weaponization of Ignorance in the Age of Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henry Giroux.
Thank you, Ian. It's always a pleasure to be on the show.
Well, thank you, Henry. And, you know, you talk about this country being beset by malicious ignorance forged in the arrogance of refusing to think hard about an issue, and nothing more is more to the point in terms of what you're saying than what we're enduring now with a entirely racist fiction over a border wall that Donald Trump began his campaign demonizing Mexicans, and he's actually managed to shut down the government, and he's threatening to do so again, to get this wall, which is entirely a fiction, and it's a racist fiction, but of course it reflects a racist reality. Essentially, this is a way to rile up his so-called base and keep them on board. And I don't understand why anybody's falling for it. I don't understand why the Democrats are giving this guy a dime. If you give one dime towards this stupid wall, you are complicitous. You are totally complicit in this absolute racist fiction.
Oh, I completely agree with that. I mean, I think that part of the issue is that the Democrats are not being honest in the language that they use to talk about the wall. It's not enough to talk about the wall as something that is central to security. I mean, the wall basically is a symbol of nativism, as I say in the article. And I think that as a symbol of nativism, the worst element of a kind of racist white supremacy, supremacist logic, giving any money for that wall makes them complicitous with that logic and makes them complicitous with a form of nativism that really, if anything, should be refused at all costs.
Well, you point out in your article James Baldwin's very prescient line that ignorance allied with power is the most ferocious enemy justice can have. And you watch this man, Trump, doing one of his demagogic rallies in El Paso last night, and you realize, I mean, Mussolini was a clown, but a murderer and a destroyer of nations and civilizations, and Hitler was the same. So maybe that is the only kind of thread there. I mean, there's a great play by Bertolt Brecht, The Resistible Rise of Arturo Huy, that casts the fascist demagogue, like Hitler, as a small-time protection racketeer who has the cauliflower concession at the market, and then he hires this Shakespearean actor to sort of become to elocute and march around with the goose step, etc. But the last line in the play is, "The bitch that bore Hitler is still in heat," and
yeah,
it puts fascism in the right context, that these people that become the poster people of fascist regimes are just nobodies. They're lowlifes. So we judge them on the scope of the thousands or the millions of corpses they piled up. But we don't look at them, who they are as human beings. And Donald Trump is truly one of the worst human beings that ever entered American politics. It's written all over him. So what explains that? Why do these horrible losers like Hitler and Trump and company become so powerful?
I mean, what's interesting about the thread that sort of brings all of these dictators together, these demagogues, is that, you know, they often emerge out of the collapse of democracy. They often emerge when civic culture is eradicated. There's a systematic erosion of any sense of citizenship. Private happiness becomes a private right. The culture of self-absorption is encouraged by new technologies. The media, in a sense, works in the interest of spectacles and eliminates the distinction between fact and fiction. There are no commanding visions anymore in America. The educational systems are decaying. I mean, I think that what I'm trying to say, and I think that what we need to be very careful about when we talk about Trump is all of the things that you said, but he's a symptom. He's the end point of a symptom. I mean, Trump is going to die or go away, and all the things that he's mobilized are going to still exist in the culture in ways that will allow them to exhibit themselves in different ways. And I think it's very important to understand this. I mean, I think that fascism has a tendency to exist outside of history. It's never entirely interred in the past. And I think there's a debate going on in this country, particularly among people who are progressives, who want to argue that this is not fascism. Well, that presupposes that fascism only exists as an historical relic in one particular form, and that it can't reemerge as people like Umberto Eco, Sheldon Wolin, and of course Hannah Arendt, many others have argued, of course it can. And what we're seeing with Trump is we're seeing the emergence of all the elements of a kind of fascist politics, whether we're talking about the politics of disposability, we're talking about the emphasis on racial purity, social cleansing, ultra-nationalism, the notion that America is in decline, the elevation of emotion over reason, the contempt for dissent and the rule of law, the contempt for what they call weakness, which in a sense is always about a contempt for the welfare state. And at the same time, I think we have to understand that this new fascist politics, what I call neoliberal fascism, for the last, since the 1980s, I mean, the conditions have been mobilized, economic, political, cultural, and so forth and so on, that have generated massive amounts of inequality, massive amounts of human suffering, have essentially gutted all of our major sort of civic institutions, from the arts to higher and public education. And now we're wreaking the consequences of that. And what we're wreaking is a kind of ignorance that basically is mobilized into a kind of anger that basically can only exist within the opposition of enemies and friends. That's what Trump is about. I mean, Trump is about a fascist politics that absolutely feeds off collective anger, collective emotion, and the need for enemies. Well, and, of course, all in the interest of his own power.
Well, that, of course, is how he rose to power, is feeding off that anxiety and, in effect, weaponizing it, telling his supporters that they should be angry about black people, immigrants, Mexicans, Muslims, etc. And he, of course, is a member of the club who are the real problem, which is the billionaires, even though he's a wannabe billionaire, all of which, of course, distracts the American people, particularly his followers, from the economic and existential problems that they face daily. So it's a very cynical ploy on the part of the oligarchs to revive racism, to revive atavism, and to distract people from the things that they have in common across racial lines, which is they're all getting hosed.
No, absolutely. I think that one of the things that we have to focus on here that seems to be enormously important is to recognize how inequality, which arises out of a kind of hyper-capitalism, has nothing to do with democracy except to destroy it. I mean, let's be clear. Three men in the United States own basically half as much as half the people in the bottom half of the United States. How can you talk about democracy in the midst of that kind of inequality? How can you talk about democracy and fairness in the midst of a system that is so rigged that it's utterly corrupt in almost every way? But I think more importantly, when we begin to talk about these checks and balances that you hear in the mainstream press that are often referred to as, oh, well, we have checks and balances, don't worry, you know, people like Trump, they won't succeed in the long run. I think that's absolutely nonsense. Checks and balances don't have their own sense of agency. I mean, the only agency that matters is basically rooted in the minds of people who can act individually and collectively to do something about challenging this fascist culture. So it seems to me that even John Dewey, you know, who said, look, he said, the culture of democracy and its values are crucial to sustaining a democracy. I mean, you have to have a place where culture is followed by politics. In other words, you have to be clear about what it means to educate people, what it means to mobilize consciousness, what it means to speak to people in a language that they can invest in which they can recognize themselves. And, of course, we're not going to find that in the mainstream media, because the mainstream media is driven by Trump's tweets.
And they gave him over $5 billion of free advertising to get elected in the first place.
It seems to me what you have at work here is a massive disimagination machine that never really gets addressed. I mean, there are people who are, Tom Engelhardt and others do talk about this, but these are marginal discourses. I mean, in the mainstream press, nobody is talking about how a formative culture of ignorance is really at the heart, it seems to me, of the decay and the collapse of democracy in the United States, really at the heart of it, as it is in other places. I mean, let's be clear about this. Authoritarian regimes do not rely entirely on matters of coercion and aggression. It seems to me that where they're really successful is that they can convince people that their needs basically are aligned with the needs of tyrants. And that's exactly what's going on in the United States.
And again, I'm speaking with Henry Giroux, a world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual who currently holds a McMaster University Professor for Scholarship in the Public Interest. His most recent books include Disposable Futures, Violence in the Age of Spectacle, America at War with Itself, The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism, and his latest book is American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism, and he also has an article at Truth Out, Resisting the Weaponization of Ignorance in the Age of Trump. So in 2012, Henry, the former retired Supreme Court Justice David Souter made an appearance in New Hampshire. He's something of a recluse. But this is what he said in 2012. I don't worry about our losing Republican government in the United States because I'm afraid of a foreign invasion. I don't worry about it because I think there's going to be a coup by the military, as has happened in some other places. What I worry about is that when problems are not addressed, people will not know who is responsible. And when the problems get bad enough, as they might do, for example, with another serious terrorist attack, as they might do with another financial meltdown, some one person will come forward and say, give me total power and I will solve this problem. And the day will come when somebody will come forward and we and the government will in effect say, take the ball and run with it. Do what you have to do. That is the way democracy dies. And if something is not done to improve the level of civic knowledge, that is what you should worry about at night.
He's absolutely right. And the prescience of that commentary is almost overwhelming. I mean, because it seems to me that without civic literacy and the institutions that produce it, without some sense of what the public good means, without some sense of the shared, that people should be organized around shared values rather than shared fears, a democracy begins to basically disintegrate. And I think that when we look at the deep-seated habits of cruelty, greed, consumerism, racism, and unchecked violence that are at the heart of fascism, you know, we have to ask ourselves, to what degree have they been allowed in what institutions to erode what I would call the social fabric? Especially a social fabric that makes democracy possible. So we're not just talking about coercion. We're talking also about the language that's being used in the media, the languages that are being used by Trump and the administration, the language that's being used by Fox News, which is really the Pravda of the United States. I mean, fascism starts with words. It's the language of brutality basically becomes normalized when that language is no longer questioned, when that culture dissolves into, again, the language of hate, the language of racism, the language of hypocrisy, and the language of bigotry. And that's where we are. And it seems to me, unless we make education central to politics itself, we're not going to get out of this. I mean, unless there can be a movement that in some way is dedicated to changing the collective consciousness of the United States in every way possible, through schools, through magazines, through mobilizing, through direct action, we're in trouble. Because the stories that countries tell about themselves, and as bad as they can be, they're even worse when they're normalized. And what we see in the United States is a fascist politics that has now become normalized.
Well, I know a lot of people probably are listening to us and thinking that this is a little hyperbolic, because the word fascism has been tossed around quite a lot loosely and sometimes irresponsibly, and the power of the word has been devalued. But it is so obvious to me that fascism is on the rise in terms of democratic states essentially giving up on democracy and being seduced by the strong man. It's happened in Poland. And it's happening in Poland, it's happened in Hungary, and it continues to happen. It's happening in India, it's happened in Turkey, and now we see it happening in Brazil. So why would it not happen here in the United States?
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, this is another example of a kind of enlightened willful ignorance, isn't it? I mean, the absolute refusal to think that the United States operates in a realm of exceptionalism that without question would prevent itself from not slipping into fascism. And by the way, people who say that fascism is overused really, to me, are blind to the realities that we face today. I'm sorry. Fascism, is, as I said earlier, is not just simply that's a historical relic that has no relevance for the present. Fascism is ongoing, and democracies, in terms of the forms that it might take, and democracies have to be struggled over. When you believe that democracies have to be struggled over, then you can begin to ask the question, not is Hungary fascist, not is Poland gone fascist, not is India gone fascist. The question you have to ask yourself is, how did that happen in the realm of culture and politics and economics? What's the threads that hold these countries together that allow them to slip out of some kind of allegiance to democracy to an allegiance to fascism? Remember, you know, for those people who say that fascist politics no longer matters because democracy is so strong that, you know, it's able to somehow inherently keep itself going, they use the term illiberal democracy. I mean, in Hungary, the leader there uses the term liberal democracy, meaning that as long as democracy provides security, you don't need freedom. I mean, instead of saying that this is fascism, they call it a liberal democracy. And I don't want to overgeneralize too much, but I think that what we have to ask ourselves are, what are the elements at work in those countries that bear some resemblance to what we see happening in the United States? They don't have to exactly mimic each other perfectly, but certainly there are threads, whether you want to talk about the anti-immigration ideology at work, whether you want to talk about the consolidation of power, you want to talk about the disrespect for the law, all those factors are at work. So I'm not sure why liberals are so intent on proving that democracy is so strong in the United States, when here we are on the abyss of fascism, we're falling into the abyss of fascism, and they keep saying things like, well, the word fascism is overworked, or is simply been used recklessly, or they say that we have institutions that will protect us, don't worry. I think that borders on complicity, in my estimation. Now, at the same time, I do want to say one other thing, and that is, there are moments of resistance in this country. We see it in the Parkland students. We see it, of course. There's a number of organizations being organized by black youth. Women are organizing. It's become clear to a lot of people outside of the anti-public intellectuals that we are on the brink of that democracy is on the brink of almost being completely destroyed in light of the fascist politics at work in this country. So there is some hope, but this is a very dangerous time.
Well, Henry Giroux, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay. Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Henry Giroux, a world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual who currently holds the McMaster University Professor for Scholarship in the Public Interest. He is the author of Disposable Futures, Violence in the Age of Spectacle, America at War with Itself, The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism. And his latest book is American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. And he also has an article at Truthout, Resisting the Weaponization of Ignorance in the Age of Trump. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now. A lady dressed in white with a man she loved.